Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel, and I'm your host on today's program, Preserving Our History in Media and Celebrating Home Movies on Home Movie Day. I'll be talking with media archivist and preservationist Jimmy Jones about both of these topics. You do want to stay tuned. But before we get into that, we're going to go ahead and check out what's going on in our media environment with some headline news. For the first time in many years, the opportunity for some communities to have new full-power community stations is a reality. After much anticipation, on August 9th, the Federal Communications Commission announced the application filing window for new full-power non-commercial and educational FM radio licenses. The window runs from October 12th through 19th, 2007, and is only open to qualified non-commercial applicants. And these are for frequencies below 92 MHz on the FM dial. Full-power FM stations may operate with up to 100,000 watts and cover a much larger area than low-power community stations. Full-power stations also have greater rights to retain their licenses and frequency in addition to protection from interference from other stations. Consequently, full-power licenses are both more expensive and, in terms of the equipment needed to operate them, and require a much more complex application process. In particular, applicants must certify to the FCC that they have sufficient liquid assets on hand in order to build a station and operate it for a period of 3 months. An applicant must also have reasonable assurance that the site that it wants for its transmitter and studio will be available for construction once the FCC awards a construction permit. Very few empty slots are available for full-power stations in most of the nation's medium-sized and large radio markets. For instance, not even one full-power non-commercial frequency is available in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, where Media Geek is produced. Opportunities for new stations will mostly be in rural areas and in some communities on the fringes of larger metropolitan areas. On the same day that the FCC announced the non-commercial license filing window, the commission also made notice that it intends to place a limit on the number of applications that any one person or organization may submit. In its notice, the commission says that it is responding to concerns raised by potential applicants that license speculation will occur. Such speculation occurred on a grand scale in 2005 when the FCC opened a filing window for non-commercial translator repeater stations. As extensively documented by John Anderson at DIYmedia.net, just three groups filed for and received free construction permits for hundreds of these translator stations, which were then sold off for hundreds of thousands of dollars to churches and religious organizations that could have otherwise obtained them for free. For full-power license applications, the FCC tentatively suggests imposing a limit of 10 applications per group or applicant. The commission further suggests that if a group submits or has an interest in more than 10 applications, then the commission will only consider the first 10 submitted in the order they were submitted, and all additional applications will be dismissed. The FCC is accepting public comments on this application limit proposal, and it is likely that large religious broadcasting networks like the Calvary Chapel Satellite Network will lobby for a higher limit or no limit at all. The public comment window will last just 14 days after the notice is published in the Federal Register, and there will be a 25-day window to file reply comments thereafter. More information is available at the FCC's Media Bureau page at fcc.gov/mb. There'll also be stuff at the Media Geek page at mediageek.net. Many community media and media reform groups have been organizing to help community organizations obtain full-power non-commercial FM licenses. There is more information on the necessary steps for filing an application, along with frequency finders to help you know if any frequencies are available in your area. Go to getradio.org or commonfrequency.org, and of course go to mediageek.net for a compilation of this stuff. In other FCC news, on July 31st, the commission released 10 research studies on media ownership, which are intended to inform the ongoing review of media ownership policies. However, many public interest groups, along with the two Democratic FCC commissioners, are criticizing how the studies are being approached. In a joint statement, Commissioners Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps write, quote, These are 10 supposedly serious studies put together by teams of economists and analysts over an 8-month period. One study alone contains over 13 million data points. Yet the commission expects the public to analyze all 10 studies and reams of underlying data and file comments 60 days from today. This is unfair, unnecessary, and ultimately unwise, inviting public, congressional, and judicial outrage reminiscent of what happened when the FCC tried to loosen media ownership rules 4 years ago, end quote. They go on to ask, quote, will the public have ample time to examine the reviews before the comment cycle ends? Is this peer review or just a brief purview, end quote. August 11th is Home Movie Day, a day celebrating the archive of history about families, about communities, about all sorts of events that are hidden away in closets, attics, and basements and boxes on reels of celluloid that are often forgotten because movie projectors and home movie cameras are kind of obsolete and have been slowly going away. But they may be valuable. There's lots of stuff on there that the world may need to see. And it will give a record of events and just snapshots of a world that may no longer exist 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. In addition, with the acceleration of digital media and other sorts of media-making devices, the ability to keep your stuff and make sure you can watch it and possibly use it in future generations keeps getting more and more difficult. So to help me out with this topic and understanding more, I brought in Jimmy Jones, who is an archivist and a media restoration and preservation expert working at the University of Illinois Library here at Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. And he tells us more. Jimmy, thank you for joining me here on Media Geek.
Thanks for having me.
So maybe first, why don't you tell me more about what you do? Because you work in the area of media archiving and media preservation.
Yeah, what I'm doing is, well, first I graduated from the Library Science School in May, and I was fortunate in that I started in this job about 2 days after I graduated, so I had a nice 2-day summer vacation. The job, briefly stated, is it's a 3-year IMLS-funded grant project that the University Library, WILL, and some other places on campus have gotten together to create they've gotten funding to create a tool that we call the Audiovisual Self-Assessment Program. And the tool is going to be free. It will be available on our website, and it will be downloadable for anyone who works with audiovisual materials. So collections managers from museums, libraries, archives, and they can download the tool and use it to assess the preservation needs of their media, to identify their media, to learn more about reformatting, digitizing, basics of cataloging, copyright, metadata. Pretty much, I hesitate to say this, but pretty much any issue that their media will face. And they can do this, like I said, it's for free. And it's really designed for the collections manager who doesn't have a lot of experience with AV media and doesn't have anyone on staff who does either. Because we recognize that preservation of audiovisual materials is time-consuming. It's expensive. It requires very specialized knowledge that a lot of archivists and museum curators and so forth don't have. And so we want to try to give them some tool that will help them to do what they can to take care of their media. And it also, aside from just being an educational tool, it is also a tool to help them prioritize their stuff, basically, for preservation. So is this 16-millimeter film in more danger of decaying in such a way that it will be unreadable than this videotape and so forth, so that they can make intelligent decisions about how to budget their time and their money. And it may also give them some ammunition if they're going to look for funding and for money. They can get some kind of metrics or something to show a granting agency or a supervisor or someone like that, so that they can kind of make the case for taking care of their stuff. So,
and a lot of people and organizations do have huge audiovisual collections. I think that they often don't think about them.
Yeah, they kind of – I think part of it is because it's not books and because it's not paper, and so people aren't trained to handle this stuff. So it kind of gets stuck in a corner, gets shoved in the basement, you know, under the leaking pipes, and is forgotten about, which is very common. And it's the absolute worst place to store your materials is in the basement, but that seems to be that's where people put it. And also because it requires such specialized knowledge and time that people just kind of forget about the stuff.
Well, why is this valuable? I think a lot of people might look through a collection and see, oh, well, there's these old movies on VHS video cassettes or even 16 millimeter film. We can just go get DVDs. Why should we worry about the stuff that we have here on our shelves?
Well, a lot of the stuff that's in particularly archival collections and museum collections is one-of-a-kind media. I mean, we're not really gearing this for the public library that's, you know, wants to learn how to take care of their circulating collection of, you know, Star Wars DVDs or something like that. That stuff's pretty replaceable. These are irreplaceable, one-of-a-kind pieces of media for the most part. So it matters because not only this is the only piece of, you know, a home movie or something, this is the only piece of film that records this particular event, and no one knew about it until just recently, say, because it's been sitting in that box in the basement. And moving images, as opposed to books, I mean, they do different things, but moving images for a lot of people are a more immediate way to experience something, an event, history, an oral history, in terms of, you know, audio media. So we really want to make sure that this stuff gets preserved and people can use it to augment their collections of paper materials.
But isn't it true that people can just digitize it? I mean, you can go to the drugstore and bring in your home movies, or you can, you know, copy your VHS video cassettes to DVD using a DVD recorder that you get at Best Buy.
Right. And that's – digital media is wonderful for access, and it's wonderful for sharing these things. You know, if you compress a file down enough, if it's short enough, you can email it to someone. It's wonderfully convenient. But because there are so few preservation standards for digital media, and because digital media hasn't been around for very long, we don't know how long these things are going to last. And film is not a proprietary medium, if we're talking about film. It is not owned by anyone. The 24 FPS or 18 FPS film format is not a copywritten
And there's no patent on that.
Right, exactly. So nobody can kind of take it away. I know, although it is becoming obsolete, film is still very valuable because it can probably outlast any other format. And it doesn't require any playback equipment in order to read it. It is eye-legible. You can hold a strip of film up to the light and see what's encoded on it, which is not possible with digital media or video media or audio media as well. So film retains its power because it's not proprietary, it doesn't require very much to see what's on it, and because the actual physical format itself, properly stored, can last a lot longer than digital media. So we encourage people, if they have film in their collections, to properly store it, or if they can't, then find someone who can, but not to throw it away, not to just digitize it. Although digitization is important for access and for sharing. And certainly if you are able to put your stuff online, that is to say, if you own the material and you don't have any copyright concerns and you want to put something online, digitization is necessary to do that.
And we'll make it more accessible because then you could take the film and put it away. Because playing film puts mechanical stress on the medium itself.
Sure.
And this would allow you to watch it over and over again in an analog, you know, not
right.
Analog, but in a copy of it. And so the self-assessment tool is primarily aimed at archivists and curators,
right,
and librarians,
yes.
But it will be available to the public?
It'll be available to the public because we're going to host it. I think it's our plan to create something that will last at least a decade.
Wow.
In terms of the information content in it and how up-to-date it is. And, yeah, anybody will be able to get to the website and download the tool. And we're still in the research phase, so we're not exactly sure what it's going to look like. But we want to create something that is scalable in terms of the knowledge that someone brings into it. So it doesn't penalize you so to speak, if you already know about the media, you can kind of skip past the identification phase and so forth and get right into the meat of it, which is, if you just have a question about copyright, you know, I know this is a 2-inch quad video. I don't need to learn about the history of that and the preservation needs. I just want to know how to go to copyright. Well, you can skip ahead. Or if you know nothing at all, you're just holding this reel of something, I don't know what it is, then we can guide you to identifying it, walk you through the steps of preservation and storage and so forth, and get you a broader piece of knowledge. So if you already know something, you're not penalized by having to wade through a bunch of stuff. That's our goal. So it can kind of be tailored to your knowledge.
And, of course, there are a lot of archives and private collections or small organizations out there who may have these collection things and aren't attached to larger organizations where this could be a great help. And I think as more and more media gets created, as the tools to create media have become much more profligate and easy to access, that's all the more material and historical record and so on that will need some sort of preservation if we're going to hope to access it in the future. And that brings us to the other topic of our discussion today is Home Movie Day, which is, again, coming up again this year. It's become an annual event.
Yes. Yep. This is the second annual event, Home Movie Day event. It is on Saturday from 1 to 5 at WILL, which is Campbell Hall, kind of on the north side of campus, just south of University Avenue. And we're inviting people to come in and bring their old movies. There are 16mm, 8mm, and Super 8 films, and we will project them for them. We will inspect them and try to condition report the films before we project them to make sure that they can withstand being projected, because as you said, it does put some stress on the media. And teach people a little bit about preservation and maybe where they can go online and in town to have their stuff reformatted if they're interested in having it digitized or put on video. And we will also have someone from the Champaign County Historical Archives, from the Urbana Free Library, on hand to talk about their home movie collection, which they've started and they're really trying to get a lot bigger. Because as they see it, and as a lot of archivists see it, home movies are not just important to the families who created them and actually remember those times, but they're potentially very interesting and important to researchers as historical documents, almost the same way that oral histories are. They're very intimate and immediate ways of viewing a place and a time. So in our case, it'll be Central Illinois from the 20s to the 80s or 90s probably. And it's a great way for people to see if they wanted to come into the archives. They can actually look through the photographs, look through the papers, and maybe also view some actual movies of the parade from the 50s or something like that, or maybe a shot of their street from the 60s and so forth, if the collection is big enough, you know.
It can really give a snapshot of a place and the people that it's hard to get even just from snapshots.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And this is a nationwide event.
It is an international event.
International
event. This is the fifth year for it. It's all over the country, but there's also events in Canada, the UK, Japan. I believe there's maybe one or two in Australia even. So it's all over the world. It's gotten very, very big very quickly. And people turn out in droves. I mean, people really like it. Last year, we had a line out the door within the first hour of the event. And people were very excited about it. We had a really good time.
Well, we're really at this interesting moment, I think, when we're going through almost a format a week, it feels like. With digitization, it's brought us increasingly better technology in some ways. But what it means is I know so many people who come to me and say, I've got this closet full of Beta video cassettes, or I've got these reel-to-reels that my dad had and left to me, or I've got all these things, or I have all these reels of film. I don't know where to get a projector.
Right.
I wouldn't know how to work it if I did.
Right.
And, you know, they really do want to unlock the memories and the events and the history that's recorded on them.
Right, exactly. And I think that's probably the number one question that we get. Well, there are two big questions. The first question at Home Movie Day is, where can I get my stuff transferred? And the second question is, I've got this old projector. How do I find out how to fix it? Or what's wrong with it? Or where do I get a projector? And so forth. So there are people who just want to transfer their stuff and they don't really care that much about the film. And then there's also the collector who actually really cares about the film as an artifact, as well as the information that's encoded upon it. So we kind of cater to both types of people.
Now, you've studied this a lot longer than I have, but it appears to me, I mean, we are at an interesting moment because for I mean, audiovisual technology, as we think of it, is only about 100 years old. And for a long portion, things are pretty stable.
I mean,
film as a medium has been incredibly stable. Then records and to some extent magnetic tape, also very stable, decades and decades of use. Now falling out of disuse, manufacturers are going away, you know, both for the media itself and for the playback stuff. And then with a lot of the electronic media even, we're seeing these formats are having lifespans of less than a decade. Is that really placing a lot of demands, and is it really making a new challenge for people who wish to preserve these things?
Oh, the challenge is enormous. I mean, and you're right, it is a new format a week. I can't stay up on it. I mean, and then we start getting into different digital file formats. And I'm sure that your listeners have had this happen where they have a DivX file that QuickTime can't read, or they have a Windows Media file, but they don't have the right Windows Media Player. Or, you know, it's obnoxious. And that's where the proprietary problem comes in. And that's where film trumps those. Although, I recognize that it's hard to find a projector. It's hard to play back your film. Film is becoming obsolete, sadly. But the power in terms of the archival sense is that, again, no one owns it, and it will probably outlast all of these things.
And the reason why we have format wars like the old VHS versus Beta, it's really patent versus patent.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And VHS was, oh, who was VHS? Was that?
It was JVC Victor.
JVC, right. Yeah, and then Beta was Sony.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it's really not even, you know, so much the technical merits, so much as just the ability to make agreements, get people to support your format. The same thing which we're seeing with high-definition DVD formats happening right now.
Yeah.
Most of us don't have high-definition DVD players for that very reason.
Right.
Is which one do you choose and why? And do I even need to?
Sitting back to wait, and, you know, they're trying to wait it out and see which one's going to beat the other one.
And yet, I mean, it seems as though from what I've read and I learned over the years is that for a long part of early history of audiovisual materials, preservation and archiving really wasn't paid much attention to because they were considered ephemeral items. Why would we want to save these? I mean, so many films degraded or were destroyed or lost.
Exploded, yeah.
Exploded, right? He went back when the stock itself was flammable because – no one took care. They felt, okay, well, we made the film, we've distributed it, we've shown it, and now we throw it into a closet. And who's going to care to get back to the original reels?
Yeah, the very first film collections in the Library of Congress were actually paper. The films were printed on paper and submitted that way for inclusion in the Library of Congress.
How was that done?
You know, I'm not exactly sure.
Well, so did you just get frame-by-frame pieces of paper?
Yeah, well, I know what it looks like. It looks like pieces of paper and, you know, if you can imagine laying a strip of film over a piece of paper and, you know, leaving the image behind that way.
Right, okay. Kind of like a contact sheet you would
make for
photographs.
Almost,
still
like
photographs.
Architectural blueprint type of thing, and it was submitted that way.
Wow.
And part of that was because nitrate was so dangerous.
Right.
And I think part of it was also kind of the how film was treated at the time. It was something of a curiosity. It was becoming an aesthetic and becoming an art form and becoming a great way to record history, like the Spanish-American War in the 1890s and so forth. But people didn't really know what to do with it yet in terms of preservation. And, yeah, I mean, I've heard varying different statistics of how many films have been lost since, you know, in the silent era. And there are a lot of people that say, you know, it could be as much as like 70%.
Wow.
Of the films were lost. I don't know that that's true. I've heard people kind of squabble over that number, so I'm not sure what the actual figure is. But it's vast. I mean, there's a large amount of stuff was lost.
Because at the time, no one really thought we should save this. And I know that even the Pacifica Archives, which has great archives of a lot of audio and interviews from the 50s and 60s during a time of social change, a lot of their stuff was lost because they used magnetic tape stock. And a lot of it was reused because tape stock was so expensive.
Yeah.
Who knew that 20 years, 30 years from now, this would be considered historically important?
Yeah, it's kind of the golden age of television, you know, the 50s and 60s. Tape was actually... tape stock was actually very, very expensive, and it was reused over and over and over again. That's what it was made for. That's why the the studios liked it so much is because it didn't take up space. They didn't have to pay for printing.
Film couldn't be used over and over again.
Right, exactly. You know, the film at 11 thing where, you know, they would say that because we shot the film, we have to have it processed, and then we can show it to you at 11. Well, with the tape, it's a little bit quicker and easier, but the tape gets reused over and over and over again. So there's a big gaps in the historic record from television.
So as a preservationist, mm-hmm. as an archivist, I mean, what is your advice to the average person who may have films or audio cassettes, mm-hmm. pictures, whatever that they have of their own lives or things that they've recorded with their family members or produced in their lifetime?
Well, I recommend keeping all of these media. I don't recommend throwing them away. If you don't want to care for it yourself, if you don't want to have to find a cool, dry area to put it, you don't have the space for it, I'd recommend contacting an archive and saying, hey, I've got all of this stuff. It might be interesting, you know, it might be good for your collections. And a lot of archives will give you copies of it if you donate the stuff. And it may take them a while to do it because they have a backlog. But a lot of the time they will give you, if you give them your film, they will give you a video dupe of it, so forth. Now, I'm not sure if that's what the Urbana Free Library is planning on doing. That's something to ask on Saturday when people come in. But a lot of the times you can make those kinds of arrangements. So you can get the stuff, you know, you can get the information off of it, which is what most people really care about.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have people don't have a VCR anymore. You mm-hmm. know, I have all these tapes. I don't know what to do with them. You know, I have all these films. I have all this vinyl and so forth. Sometimes you can take them to places that will give you a copy, and you will know at the same time that your stuff's being preserved, and it's also being made accessible if that's what you want. So other people can profit from your material. They can look through it. They can learn about it, so forth.
And so, once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, Home Movie Day is when and where?
It is at WILL. That's Campbell Hall on the U of I campus, and it is from 1 to 5 on Saturday.
And they're at the corner of Goodwin and Main Street in Urbana?
It's Goodwin and Main Street, yeah. It's on Goodwin. I think it's like a block south of University.
And for people who are listening online or listening on our stations, where can they learn more about Home Movie Day and some of these preservation issues?
A couple of places. If they want to learn about the local Home Movie Day, they can go to WILL's website. It's WILL.UIUC.edu, and there should be a note on the front page about Home Movie Day. Or if you want to learn more about home movie preservation and kind of the larger home movie effort, it is homemovieday.com. It's all one word, homemovieday.com.
Well, Jimmy, I'm glad to know you're out there trying to help us all figure out how to preserve the media we have, because I think it's important stuff. And thanks for coming by.
Yeah, no problem. You know, I've got to say one more thing.
Sure,
this
absolutely.
Just occurred to me. We're talking about the history of moving image, and we said it goes back a century. Well, I mean, if we start to really split hairs, we can say that flip books are moving mm-hmm. images and they go back for centuries. Or we can talk about the moving the magic lantern from, I think it was ancient Rome, which mm-hmm. goes back thousands of years. So I would be kind of remiss, and I think someone would catch me if I said that it only goes back about 100 plus years.
I said that. So you just agreed with me. So
right,
you now are correcting me. And that's cool.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of that media, strangely enough, survived better.
Exactly.
Then film stock and videotape.
Yeah. Amazingly.
And we still have it.
Sounds counterintuitive, but it's true.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks.
And that was Jimmy Jones. He is a media archivist and restoration expert at the University of Illinois Library here at Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, and Free Radio Olympia Media in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.